I take it people are done. Yes. Do make sure that your name is on it someplace, doesn't matter.
One side
will do. Three names on here. Two of them are star. All three of them are stars, I guess. couldn't avoid it. So pretty much, the only thing that people get wrong on this occasionally is location of Algol. It's not the brightest star in Perseus. It's kind of out on a limb. So if you pick the brightest star for Perseus, you're going to lose a big point. Yeah, it's terrible. Questions about anything? So, next time, I'll pick one of the groups of three, right? There's the Summer Triangle, and there's the Big Arc, and it'll be kind of the same story, except there'll be multiple constellations, so I want you to name the constellation and have an arrow that points at the star and names the star. If you look online, there's lots of other information about the stars, like the right ascension and declination and the spectral type. We don't care about anything like that. Name the constellation, point at the star, write down the name of the star, write down your name, should be done.
Online, you know how it only tells you the name of the star, and then it gives you the constellation? It doesn't show you the location of the actual star, so that's what's...
Yeah, it does. Yep.
Just the declination.
Yeah.
Oh, there's groups.
Yep. So for Polaris and Algol, if you click on the name, it goes right to the picture that shows where the star is in the constellation. For the groups, you have to click on the groups. And there's like A, B, and C that are next to dots, and then there's on the side it says what those dots are. More questions? And of course your SEO 01 is great for doing the same sort of thing. It has all these same star names on it, I think. So, plan today is to do the moon. I mean, you may notice that we spent, I don't know, at least 3 days on the Earth, and it's kind of going to go fast now because we just don't know a whole lot about these other planets. So there, in some sense, isn't a lot to say about them. So we'll do the moon today and then on to Mercury and Venus, Mars, and more or less in order through the solar system. So it's... this is chapter 10 today, it should be on to chapter 11 next time. Questions about anything? So we were finishing up geology. So 2 times ago we were kind of looking at geology on the largest possible scale. We were talking about plate tectonics and subduction zones and mid-ocean ridges and the internal structure of the Earth. So here we have kind of geology writ small, where we're just trying to identify rocks. So what we've got is 3 rock types, igneous, sedimentary, and metamorphic. And you should be able to name an example of those types. So this is the Granite City. So granite is a good one to name. It's a relatively light-colored, low-density igneous rock. It's typically a plutonic rock, which means that it doesn't erupt out of a volcano. It's injected underground and it cools underground. Basalt, peridites are good mafic rocks that are iron-rich rocks. Peridite particularly is present in the mantle. Basalt comes often in big flows, is all over the solar system, as we'll talk about today. So felsic means that they are relatively rich in silicon oxide and feldspar. Mafic rocks are rich in metals, like iron in particular. And we wouldn't call the iron nickel core a mafic rock. It's pretty much iron. So if we're talking about rocks, we're typically not talking about minerals, pure substances. We're talking about things that are a mess of different crystals put together. Crystal size that you get kind of depends on how long the cooling went on. Fast cooling is going to lead to small crystals, fine-grained material. And longer cooling times are going to give you bigger crystals. So I know here's kind of the picture we showed. I mean, there's more information here than you need to be able to remember. So here we have texture between the relatively coarse grain and relatively fine grain material, and the percent of silicon that we have. So here we have the mafic rocks, and here we have the lighter colored, lighter density felsic rocks, which are the ones that make up the crust, right? So mafic, we're thinking mantle. Of course, we have bits of both in all possible places. Here was kind of a more complicated view of the same story, looking at the various, kind of putting together various pieces of the igneous puzzle. So one thing I didn't talk about last time, that's why I was just starred by it, are flood basalts. And they're going to play an important role today when we talk about the moon, so it might be smart to spend a second on them now. So volcanic, I think you've probably seen pictures of Hawaii. You have a pretty good idea of what's going on there. Plutonic, can't see that in action, but it at least is imaginable. These flood basalts are not an uncommon occurrence on Earth. The Deccan Plains in India and the Columbia Basin in western United States are examples. And what we think happened here is not so much an isolated point source that ejected magma that then went away and cooled, but we're thinking about more like a linear crack that opened up and huge amounts of basalt flowed out and kind of covered the terrain, many meters thick. So that's the, turns out pretty common around the solar system, relatively common even on Earth. And the nearest example of it would be in Oregon. Sedimentary rocks. So these are rocks that are deposited subfluvially under water or air. We have clastics that are made out of individual bits like sandstone and shale. And we can distinguish then kind of the size of the pieces that go into the conglomerate that is the sedimentary rock. And so we can have conglomerates of boulders. We can also have conglomerates of very fine material and everything in between. So when subjected to typically a little bit of heat and a little bit of mineral water flowing through it, we can cement those pebbles together to make a sedimentary rock. We also have chemical depositions. So we have evaporites, where we have basically oceans that are evaporating that are making big concentrations of salt. We have limestone. Limestone modified by having fluids flow through it is dolomite. Sedimentary rocks, clastics or chemical depositions. Metamorphic rocks. So if we take one of the above and we subject it to extra heat and pressure, we can change the nature of the rock to make metamorphic rocks. So limestones can become marbles. Granites can become gneisses. Right, we can change our shale into slate. Metamorphic rocks. Sandstone into quartzite. All of that sort of stuff. We talked some about planetary magnetic fields. So we think that spin is required for a planetary magnetic field, but there's no particular relationship between the polarity of the resulting electromagnet and the direction of the spin. We see all sorts of examples around the solar system. And in fact, in the case of the sun, we see on an 11-year cycle the sun's magnetic field reversing. We have good evidence that the same thing is happening on Earth on kind of a million-year time scale as opposed to a decade time scale. If we look at these spreading centers in the middle of the ocean, we can measure the polarity of the Earth's magnetic field when the rock solidified. The direction of the magnetization is held into the rock. And as we go away from the spreading center, we see alternating bands of north-south, north-south, north-south. And we can correlate then the age of the Earth with the corresponding direction of the Earth's magnetic field. So cycle is in quotes there because there's nothing that... So the sun's reversal of the magnetic field really is, it's not dead on 11 years, it changes a little bit, but it's pretty regular. Reversal of the Earth's magnetic field doesn't seem to show a lot of regularity, so kind of a million years is kind of a candidate number for how long the magnetic field might be in a particular direction. So when we go on to look at other planets where we have a whole lot less data, how can we collect similar sorts of information about those planets? So every spot in the solar system is constantly being bombarded by rocks from space, leaving pot marks that we call impact craters. And clearly, the more pot marks you have per acre, the longer time that surface has been accumulating hits. So in the case of the parts of the Earth that we live on, they're relatively young, and so as a result, we don't see a lot of impact craters. There are a noticeable number of impact craters that are eroded due to the actions of water and air motion, which usually isn't present on the moon, for example. But even if you account for that, there are relatively few craters on Earth because the surface of the Earth is relatively young. If we see two terrains, one of which is heavily cratered and one of which is not heavily cratered, then that tells us that the less heavily cratered terrain hasn't been around as long, hasn't been collecting as much damage as the older terrain. So we can get some sort of relative age based on crater counts. We can try and calibrate that relationship based on our knowledge of the moon and the Earth. But as we'll talk about today, that would then make the assumption that the conditions on Mars are the same as the conditions on the moon. There's a certain amount of uncertainty in dating just based on craters. But you know, if you don't have rocks that you can radioactively date, then it's kind of the best thing we have for estimating age. Internal evidence about the Earth, we learn from seismic monitoring, using sound waves to penetrate the surface of the Earth. And the only planets, well, I'll count the moon as a planet, the only places where we have seismometers are on the Earth and the moon. So there's the only places that we have that sort of data. You can put a little asterisk there. Oddly enough, we also have good seismic data from the sun, but that's a month away from discussing. So the only other ways we're going to have to learn about the internal distribution of mass inside these planets has to do with some kind of subtle phenomena. So we talked about the moment of inertia, the fact that it's easier to spin something that has the mass concentrated at the center. So other things being equal, Jupiter is relatively easy to spin because much of the mass is concentrated at the center, in contrast to, say, something like the moon, which has a more even distribution of mass. So we can look at the moment of inertia of planets as a way of getting a handle on the spin rate. And if something has a uniform mass distribution, then it turns out that the moment of inertia is 2/5 times the mass times the radius squared. And this number will change according to how the mass is distributed. So we don't have any planets like this, but if we had a planet that was a shell, so the mass was all on the outside, then that would have a bigger number there as opposed to 0.4. And if we have a planet like Jupiter, where we have the mass concentrated in the center, then we'd have a number that's smaller than 0.4. So we can learn something about the distribution of mass by looking at the moment of inertia. So isostatic balance, remember, that's the situation that the claim is that if you put a pile of rock on top of the Earth, what would happen is it would sink. Just as you put a log on the surface of the Earth, it plomps down until the buoyant force from being in the water is matching the force of gravity. So this means that mountains, generally speaking, have roots. And so that means there's going to be low-density material that we don't see, and that's going to affect the resulting gravitational field. So if we have spacecraft that are in orbit around a planet, they can map the magnetic field, and they can give us some evidence about whether the mountains have roots or not, whether they're floating, and where this compensation depth is, where things seem to be floating on, the fluid that they're floating on. So we can learn something about isostatic balance by looking at gravitational fields. Cooling time. So the Earth is active because it's still hot on the inside. Part of that reason has to do with radioactive decay. Part of it has to do with just leftover heat from the formation. And you know that the bigger the object, the longer it's going to take it to cool. So we expect that geological activity is going to correlate to the size of the object. Questions on any of that? Okay, so I want to take a look at some of these videos one last time that show us how the Earth works, just to remind you about these processes that we really talked about two times ago, like subduction and... I thought I wanted to show you these. Oh, okay. So subduction and rift zones, we saw them before, but they're important enough to understand that I think it's worth doing it one more time. And at the same time, we can take a look at some pictures of the moon, as opposed to spending lots of time turning things on and off. Okay, so here we have a zone where we have a divergent boundary. Typically this happens under the ocean in one of these mid-ocean rift zones. Material really is coming in, solidifying and pushing the continents apart. And this is why the continents are in motion. The continents are made out of fairly buoyant stuff, low-density stuff, so it's pretty hard to sink a continent. But the oceanic crust is relatively higher density, and under the right circumstances, it'll sink. Presumably we have a convection zone underneath in the asthenosphere that is carrying this whole thing along. Not uncommonly, we're going to have remelting of the subducted plate, and we're going to get volcanoes as a result on the plate that it's moving under. In fact, outside of California, we don't really have either of those. We have plates that are going past each other sideways, and we're getting scraping that's causing the earthquakes there. Here's another view of this mid-ocean rift zone. Stuff is coming up, producing these dikes of material that solidifies and moves the continents apart. Centimeters per year, so it's not a big phenomenon, but over millions of years we can have the continents pushed quite noticeably together or apart. So here's another view of subduction. One plate moving under the other, remelting, producing volcanoes on the side that of the continent that's actually surviving. So Hawaii, it's a volcano that's not at a plate boundary, and what we think is happening there is a hotspot volcano where we have something that's in the lower mantle that is pushing magma up. As the plate goes by, we get a volcano that is then cut off, and so we get a chain of volcanoes in the case of Hawaii. So a plate's moving by, a hotspot that's deeper in the Earth. I know, questions on these cheesy pictures? I can't draw them on the board as well as the animations work. The continents are in motion. They're moving around. So similarly, I can't show you really, we're going to be talking about the moon most of today, so I wanted to show you some pictures that I can't draw immediately of the moon. So these are obviously colored pictures. I mean, the moon really is pretty gray, in fact pretty dark gray as it turns out. Only looks whitish because it's being contrasted with a black sky. And what we show here is elevations. So the blue areas are just regions that have relatively low elevations, and the lighter colors, the going into the yellows, are regions that have higher elevations. And you can see pretty obviously these pot marks, you saw them through the telescope in lab, those are impact craters where big rocks ran into the moon and left a pot mark behind. And you can see there's a radical difference, and you should have seen this in the telescope the other night, there's a radical difference in the sorts of terrain. We have terrains that are highly cratered, and hence we know are pretty old, and we have terrains that have a few craters, more craters than we have in the United States, say, but way fewer than what we have in the other regions. So these regions that are highly cratered, we call those the highlands, because they are high, and these regions where we have relatively smooth rocks, they were named by the Latin word for sea, mara. And you can see we've got lots of separate mara. Not uncommonly, these mara seem to have a relatively circular shape. And so the best guess is that those are huge impact craters that existed for hundreds of millions of years as impressions, and then later, in an unrelated phenomena, were filled in, since they were low-lying areas, were filled in with these flood basalts. So we're thinking that there are huge flood basalts that covered, you can see, a good fraction of the surface of the moon. Not all low spots have corresponding mara, are currently filled in with mara. We have old impact basins which for some reason didn't get filled in with lava, particularly in the southern hemisphere of the moon. So this is the side of the moon that we see every day, right? The moon's a synchronous rotator. We only see one side from Earth. And the kind of man in the moon picture that you can see with your eye is a result of these visually, again, this is a false color image, visually darker mara that are made out of the darker mafic basalt rock as opposed to the anorthosite rock that is part of the highlands. So we have old, heavily cratered highlands, presumably left over more or less original crust of the moon, and we have filled in low layers with these flood basalts. Now, surprisingly, the other side of the moon is very different from the side we see. So it's almost exclusively highlands. So we have a real dimorphic, real difference in terrain on the opposite sides of the moon. And this turns out to be not an uncommon feature with other planets, that they're not particularly spherically symmetric. So I mentioned this big impact crater that's in the southern hemisphere of the moon that is not filled in with flood basalts, and that's that one. But this is the Sea of Moscow, which is the one big mara. The Russians were the first ones to image the far side of the moon, so lots of features have Russian names. But generally speaking, we've got lots of highlands on this side of the moon. Now, kind of at first guess, you might guess that there's something that's related to that, to the Earth's pull, you know, pulling the, I don't know, magma out of the rock or something on the side. But remember, with tidal forces, it's the same, whether you're on the side of the moon that's facing the Earth or the side of the moon that's facing away from the Earth. So it's whatever is causing this phenomena isn't related to the to some sort of direct connection to the tidal force. So there's been a recent reanalysis of the Apollo data. So we have these seismometers that the Apollo astronauts left on the surface of the moon. And so we have some seismic data. And this is kind of the most recent reanalysis of this data using better computers than we had in 1970. And the best guess now is that the moon actually, how can I phrase this? So the moon has a much smaller iron core than the Earth does. So that's the first point. Lots less iron than the Earth has. But like the Earth, it turns out that a best guess is that it also has this inner outer core like the Earth has. Okay, so everything's much reduced, but kind of the same basic phenomena is going on. So earthquakes. So we do have moon. So earthquakes, you know, are tens of kilometers deep, typically on the Earth, which I would call relatively shallow, and they have to do with these plates sticking and then releasing their built-up elastic energy. In the case of the moon quakes that we have are, first of all, hugely rarer. And that's because we don't have plates in motion. We have a very thick crust. We don't have any of the phenomena that's associated with plate tectonics. We don't have any mountains. These highlands you can see are mostly just leftover crust. They're not the sort of things like the Rockies or the Himalayas that have to do with continents and collision. We can kind of pick out those features, incidentally, on the Earth because they are linear features, since they are the collision of two plates. So something like the Andes, this long line of mountains, more or less in a straight line, that's a sure sign of plate tectonics. And we're not going to see anything like that on any other planet. Linear features like that, plates in collision, seem to be a particular phenomena of Earth. So the moon quakes are deep. They're not close to the surface of the planet, and they seem to be correlated to tidal stresses. So it's the Earth's effect on the moon that is shifting the rocks around a little bit to make extremely mild moon quakes, which we can detect and then use that sound in order to image the inside of the moon. So I don't know, where have we landed? Most of the landings have been on the side of the moon that we can see for obvious reasons, right? So we can use radio to get the information back. So I don't know, these are all the pot marks that are the areas that have been visited. I think it's only the Russians have landed things on the back side of the moon. It's a much more difficult thing to do. So you know that the astronauts return with, I don't know, 400 kilograms of rocks, something like that. The Russians have had much smaller gram scale returns of lunar material. And we also have a handful of what we think are lunar meteorites, that is to say rocks that were chipped off the moon and have ended up falling to the Earth, and we can collect them. So we do have 99% of material we have from the moon comes from the Apollo program, but we do have a handful of other sources. And as you might guess, Apollo is going to land in the easiest possible spots. You're not going to land on some bumpy ground. So almost all of the material we have is from the Mara. And so it may not be exactly characteristic of the planet as a whole. Now the idea is that the moon is such a blasted place that you can pick up rocks from any place that had their origin any place on the surface of the moon, any place you go, because the things have been stirred around by impacts. So we think we do have pieces of the highlands, even though we haven't actually landed there. So this is a graph that shows kind of the relative concentration of various elements in various pieces of the moon. And I don't know, you can kind of take your own pick on this. The story of the moon is it's similar but different from the Earth, right? How else could it be? And the similarities and the differences are enough that it's a little bit problematical to come up with an idea of how the moon would form. If we made a similar graph to this for Mars, we think we would find pretty big differences between the concentrations of materials on Mars and the concentrations on Earth. So here there are some differences, but they're not huge. And probably the biggest difference, I would claim, the most noticeable difference, has to do with sodium and potassium. So they're nearly absent from the lunar surface, and they're present in noticeable concentrations on the Earth. Sodium and potassium are solids at room temperature, but they melt at pretty low temperature. So they're relatively volatile materials compared to, say, rock. And so we take this as a hint that the refractory elements, the elements that have relatively high melting points, are relatively common on the moon, and the relatively low melting material is uncommon on the moon, to indicate that the moon underwent some sort of extreme event that heated it to high temperatures and led to the release of the the volatile elements like potassium and sodium. Let's see what the next one is. So we're trying to get a picture of the age of the moon, and overall, the moon is way, I've got a transparency here, is way older than the Earth is. You know, again, kind of no surprise. The Earth is constantly being refreshed by the plate tectonics, but even the oldest parts of the Earth are younger than a typical piece of the moon. So here we have kind of a survey of how we think things worked out on the Earth. So here's the formation of the Earth soon after the formation of the solar system. We think that the planets took on the order of 100 million years, so that's 0.1 billion years in order to form. So formation of the solar system at 4.6 or so billion years ago, and formation of the Earth, say 4.5 billion years ago. Now, as you go back in time, there are rarer and rarer instances that rocks have survived through all that time, through all of this churning that is plate tectonics. So the oldest small piece of rock that we have on Earth is a zircon grain from Australia that goes back 4.4 billion years ago. And that's actually a little bit anomalous. We've got kind of a range, 4.3, 4.4 billion years old. So the oldest pieces we have that are, you know, really rocks that you might be able to hold in your hand are more like 4 to 3.8 billion years old. And I told you that, for example, the banded iron formation, which is pretty old by typical standards, you know, is way down here at about 2 billion years old. So the Earth is pretty young. This gap between when we have the formation of the Earth and we seem to have big pieces that have survived have led to the possibility, hypothesis, that maybe things were not very calm in the vicinity of the solar system, particularly at around this period of 4 billion years ago. So this is called the theory of the late heavy bombardment. And kind of traditionally, if you were going to go back and look at papers describing the history of the solar system 10 years ago, people were assuming that the impact rate kind of declined monotonically. So that the further back you went in time, the more leftover rocks there were, and those rocks got used up, and so there were fewer and fewer impacts as time went on. And certainly it's the case, we can do the calculation that the current impact rate is insufficient to have cratered the moon to the current extent. So it must have been a lot heavier in the past. So recently people have again reanalyzed the Apollo data, and they've noticed that it seems like lots of the rocks that they picked up had pretty much the same age, this age range of about 4 to 3.8 billion years ago. So kind of the new hypothesis is that there was this late heavy bombardment, that things were obviously rocky at the beginning, they started to decline, and then we had a huge influx of objects that were hitting the Earth and the Moon. And this influx destroyed the previously existing crust on the Earth. So the Earth was solid in this region, and then the crust got destroyed again at about 4 billion years ago. So we have bits of crust that are 4.4 billion years old, but we don't have any big pieces of crust that are left over until we reach 4 billion years ago. So there are reasons not to believe this hypothesis too. You don't have to believe this, but it's currently probably the most accepted version of the history of the moon. Questions on any of these pretty pictures? So here's kind of the old view of the bombardment history. You know, pretty much straight line sort of things. So do notice that the mirror formed substantially later than this bombardment. So again, if there was this big bombardment at roughly 4 billion years ago, it's not particularly key to the formation of the mirror, which happened half a billion years later. And some of the more recent impact craters are, you know, only a few billion years old. So again, if we make a comparison between typical Earth rocks and typical moon rocks, so these aren't typical Earth rocks. These are from the continental cores, where we expect to find the oldest rocks, like the Canadian Shield. And here's what we see with the moon. So the moon rocks, a typical moon rock is going to be way older than a typical Earth rock. And of course, the highlands being our best guess, the remaining crust that wasn't destroyed, no surprise that they're going to be among the oldest things. This is actually a relatively young impact crater on the moon, so you can see kind of the size, hundreds of miles. It's a particularly big one, and we have fractured rock that's going to go to great depths. Not uncommonly, what happens when these impacts occur is they shoot out dust in all directions, and so we get rays, what are called rays, linear features, piles of dust that are pointing outward from a relatively recent impact crater. Over time, by miscellaneous other impacts, those rays are going to be eliminated, so you're only going to see them in the youngest sorts of craters. So here's kind of a picture, a great exaggeration, picture of one explanation for this difference between the near side and the far side. So if we can measure the depth of the crust using these using satellites to measure the gravitational field, and the crust is thicker on the far side than it is on the near side. So the idea is that these flood basalts had to go through a thinner distance in order to reach the molten material that was underneath, and then to fill in the previously existing impact craters. So we've got seismic sensors on the surface of the moon. This is kind of a diagram showing that data that we have, from which we try and reconstruct what the structure is of the interior of the moon. And the moon is hugely less seismically active compared to the Earth. So we don't have nearly as much data on the interior of the moon as we would like. So one of the things that they did early on was to crash spacecraft into the moon in order to make moonquakes so that they could then kind of figure out the interior of the moon. So here's another picture of this kind of picture we have for the moon. Relatively thin crust towards the Earth, relatively thick crust away from the Earth. We've got moonquakes that are at great distance. We think we have iron core, which is probably melted on the outside and solid on the inside, similar to the Earth. Okay. So how did the moon form? Well, the problem is that the chemical data, if we look at the isotopes, so you remember that isotopes are chemical compounds that behave the same chemically but have detectably different masses because they have different numbers of neutrons in the nucleus. So if we look at the isotopes and the elements, the upshot of looking at the moon is this similar but different. And if you're going to try and put a better statement on it, you'd comment that the moon seems to be depleted in the volatile elements. So about the only way people can come up with that would explain this sort of situation is that the moon formed from some sort of massive collision with the Earth. So the idea is we had an Earth, a pre-Earth, and say a Mars-sized object that ran into the Earth, not dead center, but kind of with a glancing blow. And what it did is it knocked off particularly the crustal material of the Earth. And so what we have is a blob here that is generally lacking in iron, right? Because the iron of the Earth is sitting here in the core. It's not going to be knocked out very much. And we have an iron core there that we think is going to end up combined with the Earth's core. So we have material that is basically surface material from both the Earth and this collider. And it's going to be heated to high temperatures in this collision process. And as a result, we're going to end up with depleted volatiles. So kind of theories that are other sorts of options have to do with capture. And it turns out that what goes in comes out. That is to say, if you have something that's dropped from great distances on the Earth, it's going to orbit around the Earth and go back to those same sorts of distances. So if something came in from infinity, energy conservation says it's going to go out to infinity. So there's no way to capture a moon from that was freely floating around the solar system unless we have some sort of energy loss mechanism that can have the thing lose a lot of energy in the immediate vicinity of the Earth. And it's just hard to imagine situations which would allow that sort of capture. And of course, if the moon formed someplace else, we have this problem that it seems to be so similar to the Earth.
Do they think that we might have had rings around the Earth at one point, maybe that created the...
So the best guess is that this collision would have thrown up, you know, not just this blob, but a lot of other debris, which probably would have formed something like a ring. And it may be worth putting a time frame on this. This would have happened way at the beginning. So we were talking about this early late bombardment at 4 billion years ago, and we were talking about the formation of the Mara. We're talking here about, you know, 4.5 billion years ago, right at the start. Not anything that would be recorded in any sort of rocks today. More questions? So it'd be nice if we had measured the moon and it was either exactly the same or it was way different, then we would have kind of a better handle on how it was formed. But this, the same but different, is kind of a bitter pill to digest. And the only solution that people have come up with is this kind of massive collision hypothesis. And so this is constantly being reevaluated. So there was an article published, I don't know, a month ago, that was saying maybe they're too much the same. It turns out that a noticeable fraction of the moon would have come from this collider as opposed to from the Earth. But still, by far, the theory that best fits this data is this massive collision sort of phenomena. And we think we see good evidence of it happening not just for the Earth and Moon, but lots of places around the solar system. And it makes good sense, right? If things were building up out of nothing, there should be large rocks left over, rocks of all sorts of sizes, and they should be constantly colliding in those 100 million years that the planets are building up. So I want to make sure I write down some of the names of these surface features that we talked about. So we've got Hylands, and we've got Mara. Right, so these are the flood basalts that, I don't know, 3.5 billion years ago filled in the low areas of the moon. And of course, we've got impact craters that are dotting the surface of the moon that allow us to get some evidence for the age of the corresponding terrain. If we look in greater detail at additional features, I commented ago that the youngest impact craters seem to have lighter material that is ejected from it and form these things that are called rays. If we look in particular in the Mara, not uncommonly we will see kind of sinuous features that are valleys. And we don't think they're river valleys because we don't think the moon ever had liquid water on it. These were probably lava flowing. I'll call them lava rivers, but we actually think a lot of it was probably underground in lava tubes that then collapsed. And these things are called rills. Generally speaking, we don't see anything like, you know, your typical volcano on the surface of the moon. There are some domes that might be leftover shield volcanoes, or probably as much as anything in terms of, remember I talked about flood basalts coming from some big cracks. Probably exactly the same phenomena was occurring occasionally from point sources as opposed to linear sources, which then built up a dome of material producing a relatively high area. Not hugely high, maybe a kilometer high compared to the surrounding Mara. Okay, so we've got old highlands, 4 billion years old. We've got Mara, 3.5 billion years ago. Impact craters, presumably up to the current day. But people have looked hard at old photographs of the moon to try and point to a dot that wasn't there on an earlier photograph. And there's no evidence there must be impact craters going on all the time, just as there are on Earth. But there's nothing that somebody can point at and say, this one wasn't there before. And rills and domes. Okay. And I want to take a moment to talk about exactly how Apollo worked, because, so the plan, of course, was to go between the Earth and the Moon, and it's done in kind of an indirect way. So we had the big problem. So early on, I think 1959, the Soviets had sent spacecraft to the moon. So getting to the moon isn't that difficult. Remember that we said the escape velocity from the Earth is just 40% more than the orbital velocity from the Earth. So if you can orbit the Earth, you can probably hit the moon. The problem is getting back, right? So if you've come to a stop on the surface of the moon, you have to build up velocity in order to get off the moon and get back. So you have to have a rocket constructed somehow on the surface of the moon to get you back. And you have to bring that rocket with you from Earth, so there's a lot of stuff that you have to land on the surface of the moon. Incidentally, the same thing would apply in spades going to Mars, right? Somehow or other, you have to get some return spacecraft on the surface, and that's doubly difficult to do. Okay, so the astronauts took off on a Saturn V, and they started off just orbiting the Earth to check things out in terms of that the equipment was all working. And then they fired up the second stage of the Saturn V, actually the third stage of the Saturn V, to put them into a transfer orbit. So they are essentially given this escape velocity, 25,000 miles an hour, as opposed to the 18,000 miles an hour that's required in order to orbit the Earth. So, of course, the moon is a moving target too. So the plan was to get the spacecraft in the vicinity of the moon when the moon was at that spot, and then they have to slow down. They have to fire retro rockets in order to get down to the speed that's required to orbit the moon. So one guy stayed in the lunar orbital, two guys went down in the lunar excursion module, and then again lost this orbital velocity, lunar orbital velocity, and you know, on a flaming rocket descended to the surface of the moon, carrying with them what's required to get back out. But most of the fuel that's required to go back to Earth is left in orbit. So they only had to get the only fuel that was on the surface of the moon was what was required to again achieve lunar orbit. So then it's back, take off again, rendezvous with your fuel supply, and then break lunar orbit and head back to Earth. Now, conceivably, you could slow down with rocket fuel and try and get back to the orbital speed of the Earth, but that would require you to carry even more fuel. So the plan is to just re-enter the Earth's atmosphere like a meteor at 25,000 miles an hour. So that had to be done very carefully, because if you go through it too fast, you're going to burn up. You go through it too slow, you could actually skip out. So there's a very close trajectory that's required in order to lose just enough velocity so that you can impact the ocean at a few meters per second as opposed to thousands of miles an hour. Okay, so 25,000 miles an hour at a quarter of a million miles in order to get to the moon. So we're talking about a several day trip out there and a several day trip back. And in the first instances, just a few hours on the surface of the moon. Okay, so a relatively complicated process in order to get to the moon. It's easy to get to the moon. It's a little bit trickier to get back. And that's why the big Saturn V had to be made in order to lift enough fuel to actually get to the surface of the moon, the planet, as it were. Questions about the moon? So let's take a look at Mercury, because Mercury looks a whole lot like the moon, and it's going to be the next topic that we're going to take up. Do I hear it? So first of all, why do the moon and Mercury look so much alike? Because they're both small objects. So if we look at the kind of overall scale of things in the solar system, so here we have Earth and Venus, which are very close in size, right? Mars may be a third of the size. These are moons of Jupiter, and here we have Mercury, and here we've got the moon. They're not that dissimilar in size, and similar to all of these other moons. And you remember that size is going to have a big effect on how much heat you retain and therefore how much active geology you have going. So both of these guys don't have plate tectonics, and therefore they've just accumulated hits from all of these meteors, and as a result, they look strikingly the same. So we've got maybe as long ago as 20 years ago, 30 years ago, we sent a flyby from Mercury. So it's the same story as it is for the moon. If you're going to enter orbit, it takes fuel to do that. You have to slow down to orbital velocity. So it's expensive to get that, to take that fuel with you out to that distant spot. So we had a flyby and we had a series of pictures of Mercury as we went by and didn't come back. But in the last year, we've sent the Messenger spacecraft into orbit around Mercury. So we now have basically 100% coverage of the surface of Mercury. And I don't know, you can see, looks surprisingly like the moon, right? So we've got impact craters. If you look at this, maybe the first thing you might argue is that it looks like it's all highlands, that there's no nothing that's the equivalent of Mera. So here's a close-up picture that shows us something that does show exactly that sort of discontinuity that we had on the moon between relatively uncratered, material, presumably something like a flood basalt, and surrounding heavily cratered material. Now, we think that the moon is relatively iron poor because it had this formation, this history of formation, which led to the iron cores, both iron cores ending up on Earth, and only a relatively small amount of iron ending up in the moon. In the case of Mercury, relatively speaking, there's more iron than there is on Earth. So again, this is new data from MESSENGERS. So from the orbit, we can get a handle on the internal distribution of mass. And you can see it looks like Mercury is maybe 80% iron, as opposed to a much smaller percentage for Earth. Of course, Mercury is overall a lot smaller. So you can see in this picture here, the claim is that these cores might actually have about the same size, and it's just that the amount of silica that the Earth has is considerably more. So Moon does have a small liquid iron core. It's rotating, but it's rotating once a month, which is pretty slow. On the other hand, Mercury turns out is rotating even slower than that, and Mercury does have a magnetic field. So apparently we've got convection that's going on in this outer liquid core that's producing a magnetic field for Mercury, but the iron that the moon has is insufficient, or the spin is slow enough that it doesn't currently have a magnetic field. Did the moon ever have a magnetic field? Well, remember that we can trace old magnetic fields by the magnetization that's frozen in the rock when it solidifies. And based on that data, there's moderately good evidence that the moon did have a magnetic field, 3 billion years ago when the Mara first solidified. But currently, no magnetic field for the moon, and a nice magnetic field for Mercury. You might remember that Venus doesn't have a magnetic field. I know if these things are down here. So no, yes for Mercury, no for Venus and the Moon. In terms of their spin rates, you can see that the Moon is actually faster than Mercury, so that doesn't seem to explain it. Venus is an extremely slow rotator, so the absence of a magnetic field may be related to this extremely long rotation rate for Venus. Mars, on the other hand, same sort of rotation rate as the Earth, but no magnetic field. So we have kind of mixed data to explain. And best guess is that the red color of Mars is indicative that it has iron, but probably not as much iron in its core as in its surface. And so it probably has a too small core. And even though it's... So here's the size comparison again. Here's the overall size comparison again. So here we've got Mars, noticeably bigger, but not hugely bigger than Mercury. This guy has a magnetic field, this guy doesn't. This guy should be hotter on the inside than this. So you might say that Mercury might be hot because it's close to the sun. That's all small change compared to the temperatures we're talking about. So the interior of the Earth is hotter than the surface of the sun. So it didn't get that way from having the sunshine shine on it. So presumably the explanation for the lack of a magnetic field on Mars is going to be related to a lack of a liquid iron core, perhaps because there's so much iron in the surface. And also notice in this big table of numbers, the very low escape velocity from the moon. So it's pretty easy for the volatiles to escape from the moon in contrast to the other sorts of planets we'll be talking about. Questions? Okay, so with that introduction to Mercury, I think I'll call it quits as opposed to trying to go into greater detail on Mercury. So it's going to be moving on to kind of a planet or two per day, because we just don't know as much about these planets as we do about the Earth and the Moon.